Misty Winston on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Hello, this is TNT Radio, and you are, in fact, listening to the Misty Winston Show. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Before we get to our next guest, I just want to, I have a few Assange updates for everyone. So first of all, oh, ridiculous. Tony Blair is set to receive knighthood on June 13th. Oh, it's amazing. As Julian Assange languishes in Belmarsh Prison, a high security prison that has been nicknamed the Guantanamo Bay of the UK, for exposing the war crimes of Tony Blair, he is going to be knighted on June 13th, which is amazing. Not really amazing. Horrifying, maybe is the better word. I would say that we need to protest that. If you are in the UK, please take note of that and make some noise. Julian Assange, again, has been in prison for over 3 years for exposing the war crimes of Tony Blair and the UK and the US. Knighthood is not something that he should be receiving. Also, the Spanish High Court has also issued. So for those of you who are not aware, I've talked about it many times, but just in case, there is a court case happening in Spain right now regarding the UC Global situation. So UC Global is a Spanish security firm who was originally hired by the Ecuadorian embassy to provide security for the building and for the president and his family. Eventually, they were co-opted by the CIA, funded by Sheldon Adelson, and then were spending their time spying on Julian Assange. And that includes inserting microphones into the women's restroom. So this also includes conversations with his legal team. So the judge in that case has issued an order requesting UK assistance to depose British lawyers who were spied on at the embassy, some of whom were acting for Julian Assange in the US extradition. British authorities are obstructing that request. No surprise. The UC Global case has been delayed by the US and the UK numerous times. There are other countries who are involved. All of the other countries have been cooperative with the process. The US and the UK have not been. Obviously, in my opinion, I'm no legal expert, but in my opinion, if somebody is being spied on by the opposing legal team in a court case, then there's no way you can get a fair trial. Julian Assange is in the fight for his life against the United States government, and they were spying on his every conversation, again, including conversations with his legal team. So to me, that seems like that would be grounds to throw this case out and light it on fire. There's numerous reasons why this case should be thrown out the window and lit on fire. That's just one of them. Penn Norway has given Julian Assange honorary membership. So that's good. That's always helpful. It kind of lends the air of solidarity. There are just thousands of journalists all around the world who have spoken out, signed petitions, and all of that stuff in defense of Julian Assange. We need more, though. The idea that every journalist on planet Earth spoken out, signed petitions, and all of that stuff in defense of Julian Assange. We need more, though. The idea that every journalist on planet Earth is not screaming about this and standing in solidarity with him is very strange to me. This literally is the future of their profession on the line here. So it's very strange when journalists are not talking about this. Also, Gabriel Shipton and John Shipton, which is Julian Assange's half-brother and father, respectively, are going to be at the People Summit. And then I think they're also going to be in DC coming up soon. They're going to, I'm still waiting for some more information on that event. I think it's going to be hosted by Ryan Grimm. And then obviously we do still also have former CIA director Mike Pompeo has been summoned by that same Spanish court to testify about the Yahoo News article that came out in September of 2021 that detailed, different accounts from 30 plus named and unnamed sources from inside intelligence that said that there were multiple discussions at the highest levels of the Trump presidency to either kidnap or assassinate Julian Assange. So he has been summoned by the Spanish court to testify to that as well. So again, they've been, the US and the UK have been less than cooperative. So it'll be interesting to see if he actually does testify or show up. I don't have a specific date when he's supposed to be there still. I've been trying to figure out if there has been like a given date. I have not been able to find that yet. But he is at sometime in June is the only thing that I can find. So once again, the statutory deadline for UK Home Secretary Priti Patel, who is now in charge of making the decision of whether or not he will be extradited. The statutory deadline for that is June 19th. She can, however, extend that if she finds it necessary or decides she wants to. My guess is she probably will. That's been kind of the par for the course throughout this entire process. They're always seeking to kind of delay and extend and all of that stuff. They're dragging it out for as long as possible. But I could be wrong. They may make an announcement anytime. It really could come anytime. But the 19th is the statutory deadline, but she can again definitely extend that if she wants to. You can call Priti Patel and demand that she deny his extradition at 020-7219-3528. Again, 020-7219-3528. And just again, ask her to deny the extradition request from the United States. And then I will also give you the Department of Justice number, because that is obviously, we can just ask them to drop the charges. So you can call the Department of Justice comment line at 202-353-1555. And then the main switchboard is 202-514-2000. So there you just want to call, ask them to drop the charges. Journalism's not a crime, or at least it shouldn't be. What happens in this case could change the future of that forever. Do whatever you can. Make as much noise as possible. We're running out of time. Julian Assange's health is definitely failing. So we got to do what we can while we can. And again, if I have any more updates, I'll be sure to let you know. I'm trying to keep ear to the ground on all of this stuff. There's a lot of moving parts right now. So I'll try to keep you as updated as possible. And that's what I have for you for right now. This is TNT Radio.
Telling it like it is.
They're not afraid to be them.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, joining us this hour is Tony Lyons. Tony was the publisher at Lyons Press from 1997 to 2004. He is now the president and publisher at Skyhorse, and Skyhorse is one of the fastest growing independent book publishers in the United States. It was launched in September of 2006 and has had 56 New York Times bestsellers and over 9,500 titles in print. The company maintains a firm stance against censorship, which I love, and has also worked to support books that would otherwise be censored, including Robert F. Kennedy's latest book about Anthony Fauci. So, hey, Tony, thanks for being here today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. I'm excited to talk to you. I love anybody who's against censorship. So those are my people. So we kind of live in a time right now, as I often say, of unprecedented censorship. What has that experience been like for you as a publisher?
Yeah, I've never seen anything like this. I mean, there've been book after book of ours has been just, terribly censored. So you take a book like Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s The Real Anthony Fauci, and that got censored in every way that you can censor a book. So the New York Times, for example, wouldn't accept advertisements for it. Big tech platforms wouldn't let us advertise for it. It was censored on bestseller lists, meaning that it was the best-selling book in the country for about 5 weeks. And each week it was number five on the New York Times bestseller list. And they made their own book, The 1619 Project, number one. So all of those kinds of things. And then bookstores boycotted it. Libraries boycotted it. It was just a comprehensive plan where all of these places were clearly communicating with each other and acting in concert to try to make the book not sell. So that kind of thing has happened time after time, never as much as with that book. But, we published the case against vaccine mandates and the case against masks at the same time that we published the case for masks and the case for vaccine mandates, just to have both sides covered so that people could read the best arguments on both sides and sort of then have the opportunity to weigh those arguments. And in both cases, the case against masks and the case against vaccine mandates were censored in all kinds of ways. So, there's no free speech in this country now.
No.
There's lip service to it, but when it comes down to it, if you say things that you know, question the government's narrative on anything that's important to the government, then you get deplatformed. So you have doctors, lawyers, scientists, you know, all kinds of people kicked off of all of the big tech platforms in the US. And that's just sort of an ongoing thing now. And yeah, it's shocking, and it's terrible.
It is. It's really dangerous too. I mean, as I say all the time, to me, this is the front line for everything, because it doesn't matter what you care about. If you are not able to, actively spread information, educate yourself and others, speak freely on it, how are we supposed to be effective in any way fighting for things that we care about? And so to me, this is the most important fight that we're facing. That's why I'm so active in the Assange stuff, because it feels like that's a real turning point. But yes, you're right. We do not have free speech. There's a lot of service. And it's so funny to me. It's funny and also infuriating, because for example, every World Press Freedom Day, politicians put out their tweets about how, oh, it's World Press Freedom Day. Press freedom is the foundation of democracy, and we support press freedom, blah, 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 blah. And meanwhile, they're torturing the world's most prominent journalist in Belmarsh. It's interesting how they're able to, put on the veneer of being a free speech country while very much not having that.
Yeah. And what you see is, you know, signs in bookstore windows that are censoring all kinds of books, you know, encouraging people to fight censorship. So,
yeah,
you know, and then even big tech platforms are, you know, run ads about the importance of freedom of speech. And then, you know, right after the New York Times had censored, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s book in all of these different ways, and, you know, followed it up with this scorching hit piece against him, then they ran a series of articles from the editorial board of the New York Times on the scourge of censorship, on how we had to fight censorship in any way we could. And it was on the left and the right, and, you know, we all had to play our role. So, you know, one of the worst villains of censorship, of ideas that they disagree with, books that they disagree with, movies that they disagree with, then is, you know, claiming to be the bastion of free speech. So you get that in all kinds of different ways. So when the government, you know, says that they want to protect us from disinformation, you know, what they really mean is that they want to protect their own narrative. So they want to protect their ability to put out disinformation when it suits them, and to make sure that no other points of view are able to be aired, and that, you know, no dissent is allowed. But they do it in such a way that, you know, at least in the past, it was very hard to see. It was very well planned. And, you know, then they talk about how terrible the censorship is in Russia or in China, where the censorship is so blatant. It's almost like, you know, white collar versus blue collar crime, you know, where here it's an art form. And in China, it's sort of like, it's very clear what's going to be censored. So if you try to print a book in China that talks about how great Taiwanese food is, you will get a note back from that printer saying, you have to change this to "food from the Taiwanese province of China is delicious." So, you know, it's a very clear form of censorship. They're very open about what they're doing, why they're doing it. So I disagree with what they're doing and why they're doing it, but at least it's all out in the open. Whereas here, we have this double speak where everybody's trying to protect us from the things that they're in fact doing to us.
Yes. And that's such a great point too. Caitlin Johnstone, who is a writer from Australia, who I adore. And she has said that they're not trying to protect us from misinformation. They're trying to protect us from information. And by protect us, they just mean they want to protect themselves. Exactly what you just said. They want to protect their own narrative. They want to make sure that nobody can challenge it. And so they want to control the flow of information in its entirety. In the Julian Assange case, if you break it down, it really is is just the United States seeking global jurisdiction over information and journalism, because this case means that the United States can go and get anybody anywhere. Julian Assange is not American. He's being charged under the American Espionage Act, but he's not American. So this essentially gives them global jurisdiction to go and get anybody anywhere and arrest them and extradite them for publishing anything that they deem to be embarrassing or a quote unquote national security threat. And that should terrify everybody. This is, to me, it's a real turning point. Like, we're in a really, really dangerous and really important time right now in terms of censorship and in terms of propaganda, because you're right. What you just said is very true. It's now legal for the United States to propagandize its own people, thanks to Barack Obama. And they are definitely using that in every which way possible. And it is very covert. It's not in your face. So I think a lot of people are kind of oblivious to what's happening around them. But yeah, they are. It's to me, I think that the United States is the most propagandized population on Earth. I don't think that there's really any, I mean, it's not even close. You know, it is a lot more covert. It's a lot more nefarious, in my opinion. And it's really scary. Yeah, We're in a really scary time.
It is clearly a time where, you know, propaganda, censorship, disinformation have been taken to these, to a level of an art form. And so that the goal is to control people, to control what they think, to stifle any kind of dissent and not have anybody know that anything's happened to them. So, yeah. so a weaker government, you know, goes to great lengths in a more overt way. So they say, if you say this or that, or if you assemble in a certain place or in a certain way, you can go to jail. Here, it's so successful and it's so sort of nefarious, like you were saying, that, you know, they don't really have to do that. They don't have to put people in jail. They can put them in sort of a metaphoric jail. They can take somebody. So we're publishing a book by a doctor whose name is Robert Malone. And he wrote a book called Lies My Government Told Me and The Better Future Coming. And that's coming out later this year. And, you know, he started saying things that the US government didn't like, and he was taken off every big tech platform. So he was, you know, kicked off Twitter, kicked off YouTube, you know, kicked off everywhere. And then of course he, you know, on the sort of honor roll of people who are terribly censored, the New York Times wrote an article about how terrible he was. So, you know, there's sort of like this playbook, and it sure looks like, you know, it's a very clear playbook that you get the New York Times article, you get kicked off these various platforms, you potentially lose your job, or if you're a scientist, you lose your funding. So, you know, you don't go to jail necessarily, but, you know, you are put in a position where you're not allowed to speak to large numbers of people. And you have to really struggle to get your message out. And the thing about censorship is that if you have a better argument, you don't need censorship. So if the U.S. government could prove that the things that Julian Assange had disclosed were actually untrue, you know, that's what it ought to do. If it thinks that there's something in that information that is wrong or that is being misinterpreted, then tell us how we should see it. Explain that to us. But if what he really did was bring out information that in a democracy citizens ought to have the right to hear about and to know about, and what they're really angry about and what they're punishing him for is that he told the world that we didn't really live in a democracy, that we didn't really have access to true information. And, you know, what's really scary is that you can have somebody like him who's almost like a symbol, like they're trying to make a point. Where we don't want to put people in jail. We would rather just be able to sort of scare them into submission or deplatform them in some way. But if you go too far, this is what's going to happen. So, you know, there really hasn't been much discussion of whether, you know, anything that was disclosed was really wrong or was taken out of context, or, you know, is there some way that we should analyze this differently? And that's true of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. It's true of Dr. Malone. It's true of so many different people where they're just being deplatformed and we're told that it's misinformation, but nobody feels that they have to explain to us why it's misinformation.
Right.
It's just enough that they say it and then they act on it. So it's almost like an extrajudicial way of handling dissent. So, you know, Dr. Fauci, for example, you know, who's been protected in so many different ways by so many different people, you know, has said that he represents science, that he's his way of viewing the world is the only way to view the world. And, you know, if he's right, and if his ideas are so strong, why not just get on television, get on the front of all the newspapers that we all know he's capable of doing, and just make his arguments? Why does he have to work in all these kind of stealth ways to stifle anybody who disagrees with him in any way? I mean, if his science is so good, just tell us what the science is. Make the argument.
Well, he is science. He's science. Tony, Anthony Fauci is science. How dare you, sir?
Right.
You know what I mean? So, like, yes. And you're absolutely right. Sure. If these people had an argument, if they had a leg to stand on, then they could easily just refute the evidence. And in fact, Julian Assange, WikiLeaks is the only journalistic outlet that has a 100% record of accuracy. Nothing that they have ever published has ever been challenged in court, has ever been claimed to be false. He's the only one with a 100% record of accuracy. So all of these people who are pearl clutching about misinformation, it seems weird to me that they're not supportive of the only guy who's never published any. So that's, you know, it's very telling to me. Okay, we have to take a really quick break. Everybody hang tight. We're going to be right back with more from Tony Lyons right after this here on TNT Radio.
Jesse Zerwell on TNT Radio.
Just going back to the One Health High Level Expert Panel, or OHHLEP, which is the acronym that it's been given. I looked through their panel meetings. What really struck me, and a word that came up over and over, I'd be interested to do a search and see how many times this word was used, was surveillance. They were very, very concerned about surveillance. We know that this is not surveillance in our best interests, and it goes far beyond pharmacovigilance or track and trace. I just wanted to point that out, that when it comes to this One Health panel, they are hyper-focused, it seems, on surveillance. Again, we have to question why that is and what that surveillance will entail. They're not very specific in their notes.
Jesse Zerwell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Wokeness is infiltrating churches, and people don't really know what's hitting them.
Critical race theory assumes that racism is everywhere, it is in everything. These ideologies have crept into the church.
I have grown up with this invisible kind of bag of privilege.
And I know, as a white pastor, I have blind spots.
Reparations fits into the scope of the gospel.
It's a racist worldview. You're swimming in racism.
The social justice warriors say, if you're white, you are racist. And if you say that you are not a racist, then you have to be a white supremacist.
I see within evangelicalism today an attack on the very gospel itself.
Social justice doesn't have to do with justice, it has to do with Marxism.
Wokeness is now the dominant academic paradigm on many university and college campuses.
Many of our Christian universities have fallen prey.
I went to an all-black school, raised in a black context. Everything was oppression. White people are racist, cops can't be trusted, and this world is not for us, it's against us. We felt like the government owed us. I have a family, I have children, and I don't have a job. I was just, it was at the darkest point in my life.
Because I was white, would we have to divorce and separate due to my skin color?
Christianity enables people to find forgiveness and redemption. However, Marxism is completely vindictive.
There is no redeemer and there is no redemption in the religion of anti-racism.
I believe that the evangelical church today is going to have to make a decision. Are we going to submit to the culture, or are we going to remain true to the faith and take the consequences?
How the left
is stealing your church. The invasion of the gospel of woke. At salemnow.com.
In this day and age, everybody deserves the right to access phone and internet services. Whether you're from regional, rural, or remote Australia, the Regional Tech Hub can independently assist with providing advice on connectivity options in your local area, or work with you and your service provider to resolve outstanding issues with phone and internet. And our service is absolutely free. Find out more by visiting regionaltechhub.org.au or by calling 1300 081 029. RTH is an initiative of the Australian Government delivered by the NFF.
One in six Australian children are living in poverty. 8-year-old Anna doesn't have what she needs to keep up at school. With your help, children like Anna can access the learning support they need so they can build a better future. Search the Smith family and donate today.
So, you support green energy?
Ask yourself this.
How many native birds were killed by wind turbines today? Protect humanity and stop the green madness. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Hello there, and welcome back to TNT Radio. This is the Misty Winston Show, and I'm joined this hour by Tony Lyons. And we're discussing censorship and the crazy time that we are living in right now. And we've kind of mentioned it briefly a couple different times about these kind of big tech social media giants. One of the things that's really frustrating to me is the argument that, oh, well, they're a private company. They can do whatever they want. And I realize that perhaps legally that's true, and they are private companies whatever. But there is zero gray space in between big tech and our government. They are acting on behalf of our government. They've been openly doing that for some time now. I mean, we had, I think it was Adam Schiff called for Facebook to be more censorious. AOC has done the same thing. She's called for more censorship from these big tech giants. There's a revolving door as well. A lot of these Twitter executives will then work on political campaigns, or they sit on, boards or whatever. Like, there's this huge revolving door. So the idea that this is just, a private company, they can do whatever they want, is a really tired argument to me. And I think it's something that we need to really address, because these tech giants have so much power and so much control over the flow of information and discourse. It's really dangerous, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't think that they should have absolute power to kick people off their platforms. I mean, I think that, you're absolutely right that the U.S. government has been pressuring them time after time, whether it's to take down specific books, like there were letters written trying to get the real Anthony Fauci taken off of Amazon, for example. So they decided not to actually take it down. But the idea that U.S. senators can write letters to big tech companies, asking them to do something that the senators couldn't legally do themselves in any area, because that would be unconstitutional. It appears to me that at some point that's going to be held to be unconstitutional. So there are some old cases that show that, but the world has changed now, and there weren't companies like this around in the past. So it is really hard without a big landmark case saying that these companies are like the phone company. Like, nobody would say that you wouldn't be allowed to use the phone. Or, I mean, these are sort of like the right of assembly, the right of free speech. So the idea that the president of the United States could get kicked off Twitter, is a really scary concept. Whether you're on the right or the left, you shouldn't be for that, because then it becomes just about power. And what you see time after time now is you see that everybody hates censorship of things that are important to them, but they don't recognize that if you're for censorship in one area, at some point other people are going to have more power than you have. And then your ideas and the things that you value are going to get censored. So, the idea that people should be kicked off platforms you know, that should be such an extreme case. And it should be such an extreme case that anybody on the right or the left ought to recognize right away that it's reasonable. And we all know now what's happening, that, you know, when the left has a lot of power in specific areas, they use it to censor the right, you know, and that, of course, should not be legal. That's not about content that's really objectionable, that the government or some big tech company that's being, you know, pushed or even forced by the government ought to have the right to make that call. It can't be the right or the left, and it can't be just about power. We need principles that apply across the board.
Yes, and there are there's no consistency in terms of the censorship that big tech hands down. And I mean, yeah, the right does get, the left gets censored a lot too. I have a lot of friends on the left, especially YouTube is really terrible, especially anti-war leftists. In fact, the Gray Zone has a new article that just dropped, I think yesterday or the day before, where there's uncovered leaked emails that show that there's like a whole plot about how they're going to take down the anti-war left, the anti-imperialist left, through censorship and through demonetization and smear campaigns and all of that stuff. So I do think it impacts both the left and the right, but you're right. There is no consistency of what would get, I mean, for example, somebody, I don't remember who, and I'm sorry, whoever you are, but somebody just recently, I think 2 days ago, got kicked off of Twitter for calling Ukrainian Nazis, Nazis. they got removed from Twitter for that.
Yeah. Like, I mean, that's part of this whole playbook. So the idea is that, we have to be consistent, you know, during wartime, even if we know that things aren't true. And even if it's not a war that we've declared or are specifically part of. So whether it's, you know, the war on drugs, the war on a virus, the war on terror, you know, or the war in Iraq. So anybody who disagrees with U.S. foreign policy during anything that looks like a war gets censored, even if they have really good arguments and even if they have documents. So, you know, and then if you go on to YouTube and you say, well, the Ukraine war is more complicated, and here's another narrative of how we got to where we are. Not that, you know, Russia clearly is doing some terrible things and real people are dying. But in the scheme of world history, I think that you need to have a variety of perspectives. Yes. And, you know, it appears that there really are neo-Nazis in Ukraine, right?
Yeah.
And so that narrative isn't some sort of like right wing conspiracy theory now, or even a left wing conspiracy theory. It actually appears to be a fact. And notwithstanding that, because our government now and our leading newspapers and the most powerful groups in the country think that that's bad for us in some way, they then say, well, you can't say that. You're not allowed to say that. So, you know, not a discussion over whether or not it's true, but just that it's a narrative that we're not willing to accept right now.
Because it's inconvenient for their agenda. And that's what's so frustrating, because those mainstream media outlets that are now refusing to talk about it, they just a couple years ago, they were doing, like, you can go and look, there are a ton of articles, a ton of segments that were done about the existence of Nazis in Ukraine. This has been an ongoing problem. It's been happening for a very long time. The United States has had a heavy hand in facilitating that environment. And so it's very frustrating that all of a sudden now, when it doesn't suit the agenda, we can't talk about the existence of Ukrainian Nazis, despite the fact that, I mean, CNN, MSNBC, Fox News, they were all doing segments on this just recently, just, you know, like 6 months ago, a year ago. You can go and look them up. And it's not like this is some, like you said, it's not some wild conspiracy theory. It's factually based. There's evidence to support it, a lot of evidence. And in fact, the Azov Battalion very openly admits to being Nazis. You know what I mean? They're proud of it. So, yeah, I mean, it's just this whole, go ahead.
It's perfectly clear, you know, I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever that if there was a president in the Ukraine who was in any sense a Russian puppet, we would be talking about the neo-Nazis in the Ukraine.
Absolutely.
As a justification for us doing everything we could to sanction the Ukraine, to bring them
regime
to their
change.
Knees,
yep.
So that we would, you know, have regime change to bring these neo-Nazis to justice. So it's yeah. it's just about a very specific narrative at a specific moment. So, you know, yes. For example, the Hunter Biden laptop story, where, you know, right before the 2020 election, you couldn't talk about that laptop. And it was clearly Russian disinformation. And you had all yep. of these ex-CIA, ex-FBI, ex-NSA people signing off on this is Russian disinformation. Now it turns out it's not. You know, now yeah. now the New York Times has stories and the Washington Post has stories saying, well, actually, this is real. So, you know, when you think about the impact of that kind of disinformation,
yeah.
and then you say, well, you know, Biden was coming out and saying that he was going to create a disinformation bureau to protect us from disinformation. So whose disinformation is he protecting us from? You know,
exactly.
maybe he wants to protect us from the real information that the Hunter Biden laptop, which is an alarming sort of set of documents,
yes.
is actually real. And whether you're on the right or the left, once again, you should not want that, because that's not
no.
what happens in a democracy. You know, the timing wasn't good for the Democratic Party.
Yep.
You know, when that laptop
yes.
was discovered.
And, you know,
so
they were hand-wringing over Russian interference, so-called Russian interference in our election, because everybody knows that memes about masturbating with Jesus totally swung an election in 2016. That's totally how that works. But they were all talking
right.
about, for 5 years, they were freaking out about Russian interference in our election. In my opinion, the censoring of the Hunter Biden laptop story is a much graver instance of election interference. That was blatant election interference. That was covered up in order to impact the election. There's no question about it. And so it's, you know, but nobody's hand-wringing about that. Nobody's talking about that. Nobody cares about that. And, you know, it's just a very, there's no consistency of principles. It's really disturbing.
That, yes. That seems like a, you know, like a very well-executed, you know, plan to
mm-hmm.
stifle the information that was in that laptop, because the timing was, you know, inconvenient. So it
yep.
was bad for people who had had enough of Trump, who felt like they, you know, Trump was bad for America. They thought, we can do this. It's the right thing to do. It's the moral thing to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's what people always think at these kinds of turning points. And, you know, either we live in a democracy or we don't.
And if
there are no consequences to doing something like that, you know, then you sort of get into the whole system where there are not enough consequences for any kind of wrongdoing. So you have
right.
big pharmaceutical companies that are protected by the government in all kinds of ways from liability of any kind. So, you know, when people can act indiscriminately, whether it's government officials or a pharmaceutical company or any other kind of big company that's sort of colluding with the government, you know, all of that looks a lot more like fascism than like a democracy.
Yes, 100%. You're absolutely right. And a great example of the Biden laptop thing being silenced was Glenn Greenwald, The Intercept, which he founded, basically forced him out because he wanted to cover that story and they wanted to silence him. And so he left. And that's an amazing turn of events for me. He's an award-winning journalist. He's the guy that broke the Snowden story and they pushed him out of his own organization, his own publication that he founded because he wanted to cover the Hunter Biden laptop story in a real way. And so they forced him out. And that's just amazing to me. But that's what I mean. It was a blatant example of obvious a cover up and election interference, in my opinion. And I think that's really dangerous.
Yeah.
Okay, we need to take another quick break. Let's go ahead and take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a couple minutes with more right after this here on TNT Radio.
The midterms and America votes on November 8th. With his expert analysis and opinion, this is TNT Radio's Jeremy Beck.
An important recall vote in San Francisco took place on the 7th of June alongside the many primary elections on the same day. Voters decided to oust the radical district attorney, Chesa Boudin, whose soft-on-crime approach has overseen a horror show of lawlessness for the many victims of crime. Boudin is one of several dozen rogue prosecutors elected to public office, largely thanks to funds from billionaire George Soros. Boudin once served as a translator to Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez and was born into radical leftist politics. Both his parents were active in the militant Weather Underground and were convicted on felony murder and robbery charges. Many American victims of crime will be celebrating this recall vote. The soft-on-crime approach has clearly failed, but at the same time, policies to support economic growth will be the long-term crime reduction solution. I'm Jeremy Beck for TNT Radio.
You have the right to know. The right to know about culture. The right to know about the economy. The right to know about technology and to know about sports. You have the right to know about education and politics and the weather. You have the right to know what's happening abroad and in your backyard. But above all else, you have the right to know that this right is under attack, and we must work to protect it. Because in order to be free, we must be informed. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
News more twisted than soap operas, and with worse actors. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
This is TNT Radio, and you are listening to The Misty Winston Show, and I'm joined by Tony Lyons, and we're discussing the state of censorship in the United States of America, which is not great. It's not looking good. We were talking just before the break about Glenn Greenwald and the way that he was forced out of The Intercept for wanting to cover the Hunter Biden laptop story. And that's just one example, I think, one really prominent example of how this stuff kind of works. The Intercept is now owned by a billionaire, so, it's no surprise, really. I think that it's really nefarious the way that they're able to do these sorts of things in order to protect their own agenda. I don't know. Is there any way that we can effectively fight back against this? Because it seems like, we're definitely in an information war and we're definitely losing, in my opinion.
Well, so my perspective is a little bit different there in the sense that, to go back to the real Anthony Fauci. So, Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s book, like I said, was censored in every conceivable way. It was a book that had, blurbs from doctors and scientists, even a Nobel Prize winning scientist. And it, was said to be misinformation, to be dangerous. And the attack on that book was really, really comprehensive. But notwithstanding that, it sold more than 1 million copies. And so I have been seeing that with a lot of books and with a lot of platforms that are springing up where people are flocking to those books or to those platforms because they don't trust the media. So they don't believe, and they've seen time after time that, everybody likes to talk or much of the mainstream media likes to talk about things that Trump said that were untrue, that are then fact checked, and they get fact checked on 20 different TV shows. But when President Biden says things that are obviously not true, whether it's about the pandemic or, says that, things about Russia or Putin that turn out to be absolutely untrue, and that then the CDC or somebody from his own staff has to come out and say, well, that's not what Biden really meant. Nobody seems to really fact check that. So the idea is that everybody is learning that the system is broken, and they want to go to platforms and they want to go to books where they believe the information really is good information. And they believe that that they can trust this information, even though, and maybe, you know, as a result of this incredible power that's being exerted to convince them not to read certain things or not to go to certain platforms. So I think that it becomes sort of a rebellion, like a revolt against yes. censorship and against abuse of power and government corruption. And I think that that's a positive thing, and that's happening more and more. And I'm hopeful that if, for example, Elon Musk does buy Twitter, that we see that he's able to sort of unleash value that Americans really value, freedom of speech. So if people then flock back to Twitter, or if they flock back to, you know, any other platform like Netflix, when it's more balanced, then I think the whole world is going to recognize that we're heading in the wrong direction. And I think a lot of people are recognizing that now.
I think COVID was really influential in kind of shaking people out of the fog. You know, COVID was horrible. I mean, there was a lot of damage done by lockdowns and vaccines and all of that stuff. But I do think that it was kind of an awakening for a lot of people. I think a lot of people, you know, were kind of teetering on the edge a little bit anyways, but then this really kind of forced them over in terms of, trusting governmental institutions, media institutions. I think media has been losing the trust of their viewers for a very long time. And I think that's honestly why we're seeing such a really, really hardcore crackdown on independent media, because they are losing their audience and they know it. And that means that they're losing the ability to control the narrative. But yes, I do think that you're right. I mean, there is some signs of hope, but I also, on the flip side, see a lot of people cheering on censorship and calling for more censorship. And I think that there's just, to me, it was just really disappointing over the last, couple years at least, recognizing that there's the kind of love of authoritarianism is much more prevalent than I previously thought. There's a lot more people out there. You know what I mean? Like, that's what we're up against. And you're right. There is a lot of people that are starting to fight back against it. In particular, before Ukraine happened, and in regards to COVID, we saw a lot of protest. There was the trucker protest in Canada, which, by the way, it was fine to call them Nazis, but we can't call actual Nazis Nazis. So that's interesting. We had the trucker protest in Canada. I mean, there were massive protests happening all over the globe. And then the Ukraine conflict started, and that the COVID narrative seemed to kind of take a back seat. The agenda is far from gone. It's far from over. They're still working on that very much behind the scenes. But Ukraine has offered up a bit of a distraction away from the narrative. And I think that that's giving them, not that that's intentional. I'm not saying that that's intentional. I don't know. But it did offer them a very convenient distraction so that they could, because they were losing the narrative fight there. And I think that that was becoming more and more apparent. And so now they're able to kind of regroup and kind of readdress the situation. So, I think that you're right. It's kind of a push and pull. We're seeing a lot of people who are starting to get fed up and they're starting to fight back. But again, over the last couple of years, I've been really disheartened to realize it's just a much more significant love of authoritarianism that I previously thought was out there. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I'm hopeful that, I think you're right on target when you say that the war in Ukraine, at the very least, was a convenient distraction.
Yes.
You know, that a certain kind of censorship, a certain kind of disinformation campaign was really beginning to fail. And then the Ukraine war just, you know, had all of the attention veer from COVID-19 into this war. And you saw flags coming out across America, so it was clearly used as a distraction. But I think yeah. that what's going to happen in the coming months is that, you know, something like the question of how COVID started, that at some point that's going to come back. And
yeah.
the issue there is So, you know, Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has a new book coming out this fall, probably going to come out in the late fall. It's called The Wuhan Cover-Up. And, you know, it's a very alarming book. So, you know, this is going to be a book, and there are other books like it coming out, you know, that is going to make the argument that that there certainly was a lab leak, and that, you know, there was collusion, there was a conspiracy, and that, you know, this is a really complicated moment of when COVID started, and that at the very least, we have to get to the bottom of it. It has to be okay to discuss it. We have to look at the documents that Dr. Fauci had access to, their letters that he wrote, where it really looked like he was convinced that there was a lab leak. So, you know, there are lots of different questions here. And somehow they've all sort of gotten out of the public consciousness for right now, but I don't think that's going to last. And I think that's going to be a big issue this fall of what really happened. And then there's got to be some sort of truth and reconciliation of, you know, what happened, why it happened, how can we make sure that it doesn't happen in the future?
Yes. And that was something that was so interesting to me when COVID first started. And I think that honestly, this has a lot to do with that kind of awakening, which I hate using that term because it sounds so cliche, but I don't know what other word to use for it. But it was kind of an epiphany that a lot of people had. And I think that COVID was really helpful in this, because when COVID started, it was super interesting to me as somebody who is obsessed with propaganda and narrative control and narrative management and all of that stuff, censorship, all of that stuff. That's my jam. It was very interesting to me that as soon as COVID started, the allowable discourse was very narrow. And in my opinion, and this is my opinion on everything, I think all conversations should always be allowed to be had. You should be able to ask all of the questions. I don't care how stupid it is. All of the questions should be allowed to be asked. But in particular, when it's something like COVID that literally impacts every single human being on planet Earth, everything should be on the table. You should be allowed to talk about all of it. You should be allowed to ask all of the questions. There should be an immense amount of transparency. And it was quite the opposite. And I think a lot of people saw that and it was like, hey, wait a minute. Why are we just being told to like stay home and be scared? Why are we not allowed to talk about potential early treatments or early cures? Or why are we not allowed to talk about these alternative medicines that we could be taking? And it was, you know, the discourse was very narrowed. And I think a lot of people started to recognize that, oh, wait a minute, this is not okay. And that's been very helpful, I think, for a lot of people to see that play out.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this has been a really crazy time. And I think that your use of the word awakening really isn't out of place, that millions of people are seeing that there are things going on in this world that are wrong, that are, you know, that people are trying to hide from us, and that people are desperate to get stories that they can really believe, and to have people, you know, whether it's Julian Assange or Glenn Greenwald or these trustworthy people who have been vilified and who have been, you know, described as people who are putting out misinformation. And the world doesn't believe that narrative. And I think millions and millions of people don't believe that narrative. So I think in the past, there was a part of the right and a part of the left that really questioned the government, that really questioned big tech, that questioned mainstream newspapers. But now I think it's a much bigger percentage of the population.
Yes, I 100% agree. Okay, we only have a couple minutes left. I know you mentioned that Dr. Robert Malone has a new book coming out later this year. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has a new book coming out this year. Are there any other books that we should be looking out for coming up soon?
Yes, yeah, so we have a book called Political Prisoner: Persecuted, Prosecuted, But Not Silenced, by Paul Manafort. And that's coming out this summer. And, you know, that is Paul Manafort's side of the story. And, you know, I really believe in free speech. Whatever you think about Paul Manafort, if you love him, if you hate him, this is a fascinating book with incredible stories in it. And it's another case where it's clearly going to be censored by, you know, certain newspapers, certain TV shows. And it's a story that deserves to be read. He's an incredible character. He's been through some of the most important periods in U.S. history, and he was right in the middle of those stories. And he has a perspective. He worked for, you know, Democrats and Republicans. And, you know, during this period, he became this, you know, convenient villain. But he has an amazing story, and people ought to read these kinds of stories that they're told not to read.
Sure. I mean, to me, I like getting the entirety of the story so that I can form a fully informed opinion on things. So yes, that's going to be heavily censored though, for sure. No question about it. Okay. So when is that one coming out? Do you have any idea when the release date is?
Yeah, that's going to come out in mid-August.
Okay.
And let's see, we are also doing another book that I would highly recommend is Woody Allen's new book, Zero Gravity, which publishes today. It's a collection of comical pieces that he's written over many years. You know, he's somebody who's been sort of blacklisted. You know, he's been canceled based on accusations that were made that haven't been proven. He's never been charged with any crime. So, you know, once again, we're supposed to live in a democracy with a rule of law.
We do not.
Woody Allen's book, Zero Gravity.
Out today.
An incredible read.
Awesome. Thanks, Tony. I really appreciate you coming on. Everybody hang tight. I'm going to be right back with more right after this.